say more about him and what you are calling for, Nikeechi.
Well, I would just say that I was honored to work with social justice movements that Mutulu Shakur was involved with during the 70s. I've always known him to be an astute human rights activist, both domestically as well as internationally. In 1987, recently out of law school, I worked with his attorney, Chokwe Lumumba, in helping to fashion novel legal briefs calling for the dismissal of the indictment. Since that time, there have just been an outpouring, a groundswell of support for his release. He's not only a phenomenal healing in terms of healing modality, in terms of treating addiction with acupuncture. He's also, like I said, a human rights activist. There are organizations such as NAACP, Legal Defense Fund, the ACLU, Color of Change, the National Conference of Black Lawyers, Center for Constitutional Rights, and the like, who have called upon, appeal to the Department of Justice, U.S. Parole Commission, the judge in the case, the Biden, to release him pursuant to his clemency powers, to let him go. He has served enough time. It is time for him to be able to live out these remaining days in the comfort of his family and friends. All of his white defendants, co-defendants, or people who were charged in similar conspiracies, some of whom I represented, every single last one of them have been released from a prison. Only Mutulu remains behind bars. There's racism throughout the inside and outside, and even in the movement as the government targets people. Mutulu is still being targeted.
Well, Nikeechi Taifa, I want to thank you for being with us, longtime friend, former lawyer, and supporter of Mutulu Shakur, and Brad Thompson, the current lawyer for Mutulu Shakur, who lies near death in prison in Kentucky. Brad Thompson is with the People's Law Office in Chicago. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Development and Events Committee meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Every single person since SB8 has been a law has needed to travel out of state. Every single person that's reached our line.
We've been clinging on to Roe versus Wade and the protection that it offered. And it feels as though that protection is being taken away from us. So it feels as though this is a moment of survival. And I think any moments of survival can be very scary.
What did abortion access look like in America when Roe was the law of the land? Tune into KBOO's Roe on the Rocks, a limited series podcast where I investigate this question as I take you through the months leading up to the U.S. Supreme Court decision that effectively overturned Roe. That's Roe on the Rocks, airing Thursdays at 9 a.m. You don't want to miss it.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the ballot measure to reform Portland city government gets the go-ahead after a legal challenge. Providence nurses sue the company for alleged wage theft. And in international news, how Europe's energy dependence shapes the war in Ukraine. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, August 16th, 2022. I'm Althea Billings. The proposed ballot measure to change Portland city government and election processes can proceed to a November vote after a legal challenge. The citizen-led Charter Commission referred three reforms to the November ballot for Portland voters. The measure would break the city into electoral districts, elect 12 city councilors, appoint a city manager, and create ranked choice voting. Supporters say it's a big step towards making city government more equitable, accountable, and efficient. The ballot measure faced a legal challenge from the Portland Business Alliance, an influential business lobbying group. They said the ballot measure shouldn't be allowed since it had three ideas on the same ballot measure, which they said was against the law. Lawyers for the Charter Commission have referred to the three reforms as a three-legged stool, that each leg is needed for the reforms to stand. On Monday, Judge Stephen Bouchon ruled the measure could proceed since the three reforms had an overarching idea that brings them together. Judge Bouchon wrote in his ruling, quote, "Here defendants identify a single unifying principle connecting the provision of the measure referred by the Charter Commission, changing the structure of Portland's government." He also noted that even though some voters might want to consider the reforms separately, the decision that the Charter Commission made to put them all together was legal. Portland is the only major city in the United States to continue to use the commissioner form of government. Other cities have long since moved away from that structure, since it's been criticized as inefficient and racially discriminatory. If the ballot measure is passed, the commission system would be changed in favor of a council-manager form of government. This would mean that the mayor would become a member of the city council and would vote on legislation changes like the rest of the members. A city manager would be in charge of running the city's bureaus day to day. In the current system, city commissioners each have a few bureaus that they're in charge of, basically like the CEO of that bureau. Those bureaus get assigned to them by the mayor. Creating districts for city councilors would be another reform that would go into place if the measure passes. This is often considered to lower the barrier for running for office, since hopefuls would only need funds to campaign in their neighborhood, not the whole city. It would also mean that neighborhoods had a direct official in city government to go to for help and hold accountable for their actions. The Portland Business Alliance reacted to their court loss on Facebook, saying they would now have to consider opposing the measure altogether. Providence underpaid 90,000 nurses, and now they face a class action lawsuit for wage theft. KBOO's Grant Button has more.
Nurses are suing Oregon's largest healthcare provider, Providence Health and Services, in a class action lawsuit for wage theft. A new IT system at Providence caused major paycheck errors only a month after its implementation, underpaying 90,000 Providence nurses. Some nurses were not paid at all, and others were short pennies. Providence assured the nurses for weeks that the system was about to be fixed, but this Monday the nurses filed their suit against Providence for wage theft. Wage theft is a term for when employers fail to pay their employees the correct amount of money they have earned. Providence says that progress has been made toward correctly paying their employees, stating that less than 1,800 Providence caregivers are still owed money in Oregon. They also say they've implemented a new planning system to improve the administrative process to avoid issues in the future. However, the nurses' union said that, while the exact amount of theft is too large to determine without a comprehensive audit, lost wages and penalties could be in the millions. This is an added stress for nurses, who have had difficult working conditions during the pandemic. Hospitals have been frequently short-staffed and rushed, meaning the payment errors are the latest in a long string of difficult working conditions. For KBOO News, I'm Grant Button.
Washington's apple crop will be smaller this year thanks to a cold spring. That's according to the Washington State Fruit Tree Association. They say the harvest will be 11% smaller than normal, but that even despite challenges, growers have produced an admirable crop. Apples are Washington's largest farm export and are sold in 40 different countries. Five popular apple varieties make up most of the crop, and those are Gala, Honeycrisp, Red Delicious, Granny Smith, and Fuji. On another front, apple and cherry growers in Washington are worried since an enormous Atlas moth was found in Bellevue, Washington over the weekend. Atlas moths are a federally quarantined pest in the United States. Their caterpillars are dangerous to crops like apples and cherries. The moths are from tropical climates like Thailand, so not native to the United States. As for how the moth got here, there was a recent eBay ad in Bellevue selling Atlas moth cocoons for $80. The ad has since been taken down. Republican Liz Cheney, who's been critical of Trump, could be unseated by Wyoming Republicans. With more on the story, it's Mary Sherman with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
There are politicians in this country, beginning with Donald Trump, who have lied to the American people. People have been betrayed. He consistently has said that the election was stolen when it wasn't.
One of the year's most watched primaries is in Wyoming today, where Republican Liz Cheney hopes to defend her House seat against Trump-backed attorney Harriet Hageman. Cheney voted to impeach the former president, is a key member of the January 6th committee, and accuses Hageman of being beholden to Trump. Hageman asserts Cheney is out of touch.
The only time that the J6 situation ever comes up is when people talk about how unfair this entire committee is. What they're talking about is the gas prices. They're talking about food prices. They're talking about the fact that they can't travel.
Polls show Hageman winning by double digits. However, in Alaska, Trump critic Senator Lisa Murkowski is expected to advance to the general election. In a new primary system, all candidates, regardless of party, run on the same ballot, with the top four reaching November's ballot. Meanwhile, former Republican governor and vice presidential nominee Sarah Palin is among the candidates in a special election to replace the late Congressman Don Young. Rudy Giuliani says he's the target of a criminal investigation in Georgia and will appear before a special grand jury tomorrow. The former New York mayor alleged widespread irregularities occurred in Georgia in the 2020 election.
They made significant mistakes, like all crooks do, and we caught them.
South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham must testify before the same grand jury over phone calls he made to Georgia's Secretary of State, which prosecutors believe were attempts to influence the election's outcome. Graham claims the calls were about official election business.
I suggested as you go forward, can you change it to make sure that a bipartisan team verifies signatures, and if there's a dispute, come up with an appeal process.
Graham is appealing the decision. The Justice Department wants a federal court to maintain the secrecy of the affidavit used to justify the search of Donald Trump's Florida home, arguing it would undermine its investigation. An unsealed search warrant revealed about 20 boxes were removed, including a set marked as classified. President Joe Biden will sign the Inflation Reduction Act into law today. Washington Democratic Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal says it takes significant steps to lower drug costs.
It will cap seniors' annual drug costs at $2,000 per year and insulin at $35 per month. For the first time ever, we got our toe in the door to take on the price gouging by Big Pharma. For the first time ever, Medicare can begin negotiating drug prices.
It also includes measures to address climate change and raise some corporate taxes. And the White House is firing back at a House Republican report on the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. It suggests the Biden administration failed to plan adequately, but the White House countered the findings are partisan and inaccurate. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find RE Trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Energy politics in Europe are critical to determining the future of the war in Ukraine. As the winter months approach, the energy pressure on Europe is expected to grow. Now we go to a global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. It won't be long before winter descends on Europe. Before it does, most European countries must address the question of how long and how well they'll be able to handle decoupling from Russian energy. Because of the Ukraine war, oil and natural gas are the chief currencies, which means that energy politics is central to determining the war's future. Oil and gas finance Putin's war, constrain Europe's response to it, and largely determine which side the rest of the world takes. At first glance, Russia's reliance on energy exports, which account for about 40% of the country's revenues, remains firm. Besides China and India, which are buying oil at a steep discount, Russia has customers in Africa and other parts of Asia. Globally, gas and oil imports from Russia have only declined by 15% in recent months. That is consistent with the overall international political response to the Russian invasion, in which most countries outside the European Union, the EU, and North America have remained on the sidelines, unwilling to criticize Russia openly, usually out of concern about their energy supplies. Still, some experts believe these alternative customers are not enough to make up for Russia's European market. In fact, they say lack of overseas markets is only one facet of the Russian economy that is imploding. A major dilemma for all countries that are sanctioning Russia is that, thanks to rising energy prices, Russia's income continues to go up even as its deliveries go down. Six of the top 10 importers of Russia's fossil fuels are EU members, and the combined value of all EU member imports from Russia is roughly $100 billion so far. That dependence is slowly changing, however, as a number of countries are disconnecting from reliance on Russian fossil fuel exports. The Scandinavian countries and the Baltic states are moving swiftly to disconnect, while Germany, Italy, and Netherlands are moving very slowly as they try to increase their reserves. EU sanctions on Russian oil will be complete at the end of the year. Natural gas from Russia's Gazprom, which used to provide about 40% of the EU's total gas consumption, looks about to stop after weeks of being turned on and off as Putin looked for leverage on the EU. Six countries now have had their gas cut off by Gazprom. Putin is playing with our dependency, one European legislator said, especially against Germany. Putin's energy blackmail, the head of the European Commission puts it. Putin thinks he's in the driver's seat, but so far the pressure on the EU isn't working. How so? First, the G7 group's finance ministers, meeting in late July in Germany, confronted the dilemma of banning Russian oil imports by agreeing to put a cap on oil prices, with the cooperation of the banks, insurers, and other companies that enable Russian oil to get to market. Then the EU came up with a common plan on natural gas consumption. This, despite the great differences among them, ranging from Germany, which far and away is the heaviest gas consumer, to Spain and Portugal, which are among the least, and Hungary, which refuses to accept limits. The EU agreement cuts natural gas use by 15% until next spring. Meantime, it is finding new natural gas sources, such as Nigeria, Algeria, Norway, and Azerbaijan. The combination of reduced consumption and new sources led an EU official in early August to claim the EU had reduced its dependence on Russian gas from 40 to 20%. But the political challenge remains. Will the EU's unity remain firm as their economies contract and the spirit of sacrifice for Ukraine wanes? The other challenge for the EU's energy situation concerns climate change policy. Europe has been a leader on carbon reduction, nearly 30% since 1990, but it has to do more, and the heat wave and wildfires now raging in Europe should be persuasive. Germany, which historically has contributed the most among European countries to global warming, though far less than the United States and China, it should be noted, has a key role in stopping and reversing global warming. Lecturing to developing countries about moving away from fossil fuels won't cut it these days, since the EU is not setting a great example. Their fossil fuel consumption has to be dramatically reduced, and economic development needs to be redefined to suit a new era of environmental responsibility. How sad that it takes a war to realize that. I'm Mel Gertow for The Global Citizen. Thanks very much for listening.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in depth. At 6, it's Transpositive PDX, then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear with an overnight low of 59 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny and a high of 97. Today in history, in 2018, legendary American singer and queen of soul Aretha Franklin passed away. She's an 18-time Grammy Award winner, and in 2019, she was awarded a posthumous Pulitzer Prize for, quote, her indelible contribution to American music and culture for 5 decades. The quote of the day is from Aretha Franklin, who said, quote, "You cannot define a person as just one thing. You can't forget all these wonderful and good things a person has done because one thing didn't come off the way you thought it should come off." We'll be right back. A case coming up on the Supreme Court's docket could allow state legislatures to have unchecked power when it comes to redistricting. Edwin J. Vieira reports in New York.
Whether state courts are allowed to review the validity of redistricting by state legislatures is at the heart of a case being considered by the U.S. Supreme Court. A ruling in Moore v. Harper would allow for the creation of hyperpartisan voting districts that could not be challenged under judicial review by state courts. This would mean the state legislature would be the sole authority responsible for developing the redistricting maps. At Albany Law School, Professor Vincent Bonventry says the impacts of this ruling would be long-lasting.
A party in power that draws a redistricting map that very heavily favors that party in power, and therefore makes it an almost certainty that the party in power is going to win a disproportionate number of elections.
In New York, this could result in a majority Democratic rule and would overrule the decision in Harkin-Ryder versus Hochul. That case threw out a voting map drawn up by Democrats in the New York legislature that was considered gerrymandered. Depending on the Supreme Court's ruling in the Moore versus Harper case, that map could be reconsidered for future use. According to Ballotopedia, 48 of the 50 states have overwhelmingly Democratic or Republican-controlled legislatures, and depending on the outcome of this case, they could remain that way through redistricting. Bonventry is unsure if states would be able to pass laws that would blunt the effects of the ruling. However, he says he knows what would be best for the voters.
If we allow these extremely partisan redistricting by the state legislatures so that the party in power disproportionately wins congressional seats, that is clearly contrary to the preferences of the voters in that state.
He sees strong legal arguments on both sides of the case, but says allowing state courts to remain as a check to the legislature's power on redistricting would ultimately preserve the integrity of voting. It also lets voters decide who they want to represent them, rather than elected officials choosing whom they need to get reelected. I'm Edwin J. Vieira, New York News Connection.
A critical voting rights case for tribes in South Dakota could be overshadowed by a coming Supreme Court case. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A lawsuit initiated by the Lower Brule Tribe against Lyman County in South Dakota could be complicated by a recent case on the U.S. Supreme Court's emergency docket. Also referred to as the shadow docket, it allows justices to resolve an issue temporarily until a case can have a full hearing. In early 2022, Justice Brett Kavanaugh wrote an explanation for why he sided with the majority to stay a lower court ruling in an Alabama voting rights case. In his writing, he raised the bar for plaintiffs claiming violations of the Voting Rights Act. Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Elena Kagan each wrote a dissent. One of the lawyers for Lower Brule says the authority of these writings is a debate for legal scholars. But she says even under Kavanaugh's more stringent test for a voting rights challenge, the tribe is on solid ground. Victoria Wicks has more.
Samantha Kelty is a staff attorney with the Native American Rights Fund. She represents Lower Brule in its attempt to get Lyman County to change its districting in time for the November 2022 election. Kelty says Justice Kavanaugh's decision demands that voting rights plaintiffs seeking an injunction must be able to prove that the merits are clear-cut in their favor. What's not clear is whether that demand has standing to replace the previous standard, that plaintiffs prove they're likely to succeed on the merits. Kelty said she is thankful that Federal District Judge Roberto Lang confirmed in his August 11th order that the Lower Brule Tribe meets those stricter standards. In his order, Judge Lang gave Lyman County 7 days to come up with a more equitable districting plan to be put in place by November, rather than relying on the old single district plan that dilutes the vote of tribal members. Samantha Kelty says it's not unreasonable to expect the county to implement the two-district plan it proposed as a compromise, and that has, at least for now, been approved by the tribe.
And the reason for that was because the county had already drawn up the two-district plan. They had already finalized the map. You know, they had already voted on it and decided that that was a plan that they liked.
Lyman County officials testified at a hearing last month that they would not be able to adjust voting software and confirm tribal addresses in time to redistrict and print ballots. But Judge Lang said in his order that using the previous single district plan violates federal law. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
The Navajo Nation recently declared a state of emergency following heavy flooding, Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports.
The Navajo Commission on Emergency Management recently made the declaration after flash flooding impacted homes and roadways. According to Navajo President Jonathan Nez's office, the move activates emergency plans and will allow local chapters to access additional resources for recovery. Nez says emergency response personnel have been out in communities 7 days a week, and health workers have been going door-to-door, providing support for elderly residents and those with health conditions. July and August are some of the wettest months in the Southwest and for the 27,000 square mile reservation that covers parts of northern Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
The Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences has apologized to Sasheen Littlefeather for the abuse she faced at the 45th Academy Awards. Littlefeather stood on stage at the 1973 Awards, refusing the Oscar on behalf of Marlon Brando in recognition of the mistreatment and misrepresentation of Native Americans by the film industry. In a statement of reconciliation in June, the Academy apologized and acknowledged the emotional burden she faced and the cost to her career. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The state of Washington wants to make homes more energy efficient and healthier. It's looking to scale up its current efforts to do this for low-income residents. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
Washington State wants to make homes for its most vulnerable residents greener and healthier. It started with a needs assessment from the Department of Commerce on housing energy resilience to figure out what that will take. Lindsay Schroeman-Warwin is with the organization Firelands Workers Action, a group in rural western Washington organizing on issues such as housing. He says improving housing won't just make the house more energy resilient, but also remove health concerns lurking inside.
People have been told by their doctor, hey, the bronchitis you have is caused by the mold in your house. You've got spots in your lungs that will never go away because of the indoor air quality of the place where you live.
Schroeman-Warwin says about 0.3% of houses in Washington are being weatherized or upgraded each year. The state's goal is 10%. His organization has submitted an application to help the state scale up this program. Schroeman-Warwin says making home improvements would not only create healthier, more energy-efficient places to live, but also help the state tackle its growing housing crisis. He says it's common for older Washingtonians who age in place to stop maintaining their housing out of lack of funds or resources.
If we lose existing housing, then we're just going to get further and further behind. And we can lose housing through people not being able to maintain their housing. You know, if your roof leaks, you're basically rotting out the structure.
On improvements that save energy, Schroeman-Warwin says there are a number of options. Ductless heat pumps, for instance, will be important as summers in the Northwest warm up, since they can both heat and cool homes. He says it's important to get a wider perspective on this work.
Really, we have to think of housing and the electrical grid as a whole as something that we all collectively share.
For Big Sky Connection, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Some cities reimburse residents for the cost of building rain gardens or cisterns, but those programs can be hard for low-income people to access. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on that story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In many parts of the country, climate change is bringing more extreme rain. Heavy downpours can overwhelm city stormwater systems. So some cities offer voluntary programs that reimburse homeowners for the cost of installing cisterns or rain gardens. These solutions can hold excess water during storms. But without careful planning, participation in these programs may not be equitable. Daniel Brent of Penn State University analyzed Seattle's RainWise program and found that mostly upper-middle-class homes participated.
The households with the lowest housing values were not very likely to participate.
He says that's partly because only certain areas were eligible.
These are in locations that are often close to water bodies, which are generally desirable, wealthy areas.
He says residents also had to be able to front the cost of creating the garden. Even though it's repaid, that initial expense can be a barrier. So Brent says to make these programs more fair, cities should consider expanding eligibility and recruiting diverse participants at the outset. He says with planning, these programs can continue meeting their environmental goals.
But also doing it in an equitable way.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
President Biden is expected to sign the Inflation Reduction Act this week, which invests $370 million into clean energy programs. We go again to Eric Tegedoff in Montana.
Congress has passed legislation that makes the largest investment in clean energy in U.S. history. It has grassroots organizations like Northern Plains Resource Council ecstatic. Joni Kresich is board chair of the group, which represents family agriculture in Montana. She says the Inflation Reduction Act is historic for the groups that have pushed for action on climate change.
We've never wavered from a vision for a clean energy future, and we feel that that vision is within reach now. So it's really exciting, finally, after decades of hope, to have real legislation that's going to help us do what we need to do.
The bill the U.S. House eventually passed over the weekend was slimmed down compared to earlier versions of the legislation. But it still includes $370 billion for clean energy programs and is estimated to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 40% by 2030. The bill passed along party lines, with Republicans saying it only expands the deficit and size of government. Kresich says the legislation also invests in farmers and ranchers. She says they are on the front lines of climate change and depend on a reliable climate for their work.
Now we're going to get some really significant federal help, and that's really exciting.
Kresich notes the changing climate is affecting Montana and points to the recent flooding on the Yellowstone River, which destroyed houses in places like Livingston.
The kind of damage that happened is a reminder of why we're doing this, why we're trying to make this transition to a clean energy future.
For